Mark 4, 1 to 9, it's page 701 in your Bibles, if you're not following. Again, Jesus began to teach by the lake. The crowd gathered around him was so large that he got into a boat and sat in it out on the lake while all the people were along the shore at the water's edge. He taught them many things by parables, and in his teaching said, "Listen, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he scattered the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places, where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched, and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants, so they did not bear any grain. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up, grew, and produced a crop. Some multiplying 30, some 60, some 100 times. Then Jesus said, "Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear."
Oh man, good stuff. Okay, so for those that are new, the family with the greens and emeralds that's here for the first time, we're in the middle of a teaching series in Mark's Gospel entitled The Return of the King. We're looking at this idea that God the Creator, the one that walked with Adam and Eve in the cool of the day, if you remember Genesis 1 and 2, that same God is now walking amongst his people in the first century, establishing the kingdom of God. He's returning as the king to usher in his kingdom. And we've been trying to place Mark's Gospel within the wider biblical narrative. I'm hopefully summarising, no one's nodding, but we've done this in the last few weeks. So let me just put up this slide. On my iPad, I drew this, I think, last week or the week before. So this is the narrative, the wider narrative that we've been trying to engage in. It's a story that moves from creation to decreation to recreation. You can think of the narrative like a three-act play. So creation is Genesis 1 and 2, where God creates this world. It's beautiful. He creates this garden, a place called Eden. It's a garden of perfection. Adam and Eve are fully alive in the garden. But then decreation kicks in. In other words, sin enters the story. Brokenness, pain, they enter the story. And then in Genesis 6, you have this kind of like low point, one of the real low points of the whole biblical narrative, where it says that the earth was filled with violence. Plan in the beginning in Genesis 1 and 2 was that Adam and Eve would multiply in this garden, would spread until Eden fills the whole earth, and therefore the whole earth would be filled with God's love, his blessing and his presence. But instead in Genesis 6 we're told the earth is filled with violence and God's heart is filled with pain. So if you remember the story, Cain kills his brother Abel, and then you have the escalation of violence until whole nations are turning against other nations. And then comes about God's plan to restore and redeem that which has become broken, and we're calling that recreation. So Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, they tell the story of how God in Christ goes about recreating that which was broken in Genesis chapter 3. And how can God do this? How can Jesus do this? The answer is, his mission, which is to recreate, flows from his identity. He's the creator. His mission flows from his identity. So this is God entering creation once more to redeem and restore. It's what theologians call the incarnation. Two Greek words shoved together, in and carne, which means in flesh. God is in human flesh, putting things right so we can be fully alive once more. We can live the life we were created to live. Anyone remember any of that? No, brilliant. Well, that's the summary that you're going to need for the next part. So if that's what's happening in Mark's Gospel, we're reading about Jesus on a mission to recreate people. Mark 1, 2, 3, that's what we've been reading about. What is this story about a farmer spreading seed? How does that have anything to do with this wider narrative, Jesus being on a mission to recreate? And the short answer is it has everything to do with it, but I'm going to need to explain that to get us all on the same page. You need to understand parables. Okay, so parables function in the Gospels like an explanation of what's going on in the narrative. When we read parables, we think of them as nice stories, like the stories we tell our kids, fairy tales, that have a lovely moral meaning attached to them. And the plan of reading parables is to extract the nice moral meaning and then apply it to your life. So we tell people the story of the Good Samaritan. The guy's on a journey from Jerusalem to Jericho, gets beaten up. The priest walks past, the Levite, that's the equivalent of the worship leader. He walks past, and then a Samaritan, the person that's meant
meant to hate you and be hated by you. He's the one that helps out. So we basically tell people, you see, what Jesus is trying to say is it's good to love your friends, but it's actually incredible to love your enemies too. So we take this meaning, we extract it, and we try and apply it to our lives. We do this with all the parables. Think of the story of the guy who built his house on the rock compared to the guy who built his house on the sand. We basically tell ourselves, don't be like an idiot that built his house on sand. Make sure your life has really good foundations. We read the story, it's a nice story. We extract some sort of moral teaching from it, and then we apply it to our lives. And they function at that level, they do work at that level, but Jesus didn't teach just so we could have nice stories with moral truth contained within them. When Jesus spoke, he used parables to explain what he was doing. So each of the parables begins with, the kingdom of God is like dot, 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 or the kingdom of heaven is like dot, dot, dot. It's like a pearl of great price. It's like a king who goes off to a faraway country. You know, he's using these as images to explain what he's actually doing. So one theologian put it like this. He said that the parables serve as a commentary on what Jesus is actually doing in the narrative. So we're reading Mark chapter 1, 2, 3. We're reading the stories of what Jesus did. And then suddenly in Mark 4, you've got a parable, which is meant to be a commentary on everything that's just gone before. I think of it like this, and I know this is going to alienate half the people in the room, but when I watch Match of the Day, you know, the football highlights at the end of the weekend, I'm watching them and I can see the action in front of me. I can see the goals, the high points, the great saves, the horrible tackles. I can see all of that. But then I've got experts. I've got Alan Hansen, Alan Shearer, Mark Lawrenson a little bit less so. But you've got these experts that are explaining to you the action so you can understand it at a greater level. You see, the parables function like these experts providing commentary. They help us understand what's going on at a deeper level. So we've read Mark 1, 2, 3, and suddenly you have this story. And Jesus is telling this story to explain everything he's been doing in the previous chapters. Do you get it? So the stories are always a commentary on what Jesus is doing in his ministry. Let me just give you a couple of examples to explain this. So when Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son, we read it and think, well, that's an amazing dad. You know, Jesus is trying to say, your God is a loving father who'll come and meet you. Even if you fall away, he'll come and meet you. And on one level, that is what the story is about. But Jesus is telling this story to explain what he's doing in his ministry. You see, throughout the Old Testament, Israel is referred to as God's son. So Jesus is telling them their story. You were created and entered into a covenant relationship with God, but you turned your back on your father. You ended up in a far off land in Babylon. It was exile. And now you're trying to come home because you want to live life under the Father's blessing once more. So Jesus is telling them their story. Essentially, the point is, I'm coming to find you. I'm the running father coming to embrace you and to restore you to your rightful identity as the children of God. And that's everything that Jesus has been doing in the ministry before he tells the story. He's finding lepers and embracing them. He's finding broken people, prostitutes and tax collectors and paralyzed people. He's embracing them and healing them and restoring them to their identity. He tells the story of the prodigal son to explain what he's doing in the narrative. Same is true of the story of the lost sheep. Do you remember the lost sheep? You know, that Jesus says there's a shepherd who he's got 100 sheep, but one goes missing. And the shepherd goes looking for the one and brings it back until they're all together again. And we just think, wow, that's a nice shepherd. Jesus is saying, I'm a nice guy. I love sheep. And when one goes missing, I care about that one sheep. And I'll find it. So we print postcards with Jesus carrying a lamb around his shoulders. You know, we put a verse, for God so loved the world, he loves you like he loves this sheep. And we do that kind of stuff. And again, it functions at that level. But actually, for a Jew in the first century, hearing Jesus talk about a shepherd trying to find sheep, immediately they're thinking of Ezekiel 34. Because in the Jewish mindset, and remember, they knew the Torah and the Old Testament inside out. They knew that God had spoken and said, one day I'm going to come back and I'm going to restore and I'm going to recreate, you know, what we're looking at the screen. And when I do that, I'm going to come as a shepherd and I'm going to hunt down the lost and the broken and the weak. And he has this message in Ezekiel 34 to the leaders and the priests of the nation. He says, I gave you responsibility to look after this nation, but you've not done it. You've not cared for the widows and the orphans. You've not cared for the sick. In fact, you've got rich while they've got poor. You've pushed yourself higher by pushing them lower, and I will not stand for it. So one day I'm going to come back and I'm going to hunt down the strays. So when Jesus tells this story about this shepherd looking for the one, he's essentially saying, I'm doing now what God said he would always do. I'm hunting down the lost, the broken, the lepers, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the paralyzed people, and I'm restoring them to their rightful identity. All of these parables are a commentary on what Jesus is actually doing in his life and ministry. They're not just nice stories with moral messages. They are that, but there's so much more. So what about this story? The farmer that scatters seed, 75% is wasted, and then suddenly the last quarter has an incredible return, 30, 60, 100-fold back on what was invested. What has that got to do with Mark 1, 2, and 3? Well, let me try and explain it. Next slide. You're going to love these slides, by the way, for the simple reason that they took me about 2 hours to make. So if you don't love them, I don't want to know afterwards. Just come and tell me you love them. So decreation. This is the present age. We look at the world around us, and most of us could say, do you know what? It's beautiful. When I wake up and see the sunrise, or when I, you know, see the sunset, it's beautiful. When I look at the ocean, I think, wow, this world is good. It's incredible. When I look at people in the room, I think, God, you're amazing. This is a beautiful, beautiful world we live in. But it's broken. It's broken. And all of us can see that. You just turn on the news, you think, wow, this place is broken. You read about genocides. You know, I've just spent a week in Uganda hearing some of the stories in their history. It's like, oh, it's messed up. When you think of the issue of hunger, which we're trying to address as a church right now through the IF campaign, this campaign that says there's enough food for everyone, yet 2 million on the planet starve to death each year. 1 in 8 on the planet go to bed hungry, yet 50% of all of the food produced in the West we just throw away. You know, so we'll go to Sainsbury's and we'll see, like, buy one, get the second one half price. Deal! This is, like, amazing. We'll pick it up, we'll put it in our cupboards, we'll use one of them. The other one we probably won't get round to using. By the time we think about it, it's out of date and we throw it away. We do that all the time in the West. 50% we throw away. And that 50% could more than feed those that are starving and going to bed hungry right now. See, it's an amazing place, but it is broken. See, we live in a state of decreation. Yet, next slide, suddenly recreation breaks in. How does recreation break in? Next slide. Through the ministry of Jesus. There we go. I knew you'd love that. Richard Spence helped finding the little Jesus. That's how heaven comes to earth. The one sent from heaven comes to earth. He ushers in the new creation. The age to come is breaking in. That's what's happening all around Jesus. Mark 1, 2, 3. He's healed a guy of leprosy. He's set people free. He's drafted broken people, tax collectors that were despised, back into community. He's healed the paralyzed man so he can walk again. He's forgiving sins. He's liberating people from addictions and demonic oppression. He's drawing people back into the life they were created for. Recreation is breaking in all around. Now, to understand the power of this, you need to know that, again, for first century Jews, that they know their scriptures inside out. Because they recite them every single day. In the prophets that you'll find in the Old Testament, the prophets constantly compare what decreation looks like to what recreation looks like. What decreation feels like and what recreation will feel like when it comes. So let me just give you an example or two. Next slide then. This is what decreation looks like. This is just quoting a couple of prophets. Jeremiah 8. I will take away their harvest, declares the Lord. There'll be no grapes on the vine, there'll be no figs on the tree, and their leaves will wither. What I've given them will be taken away from them. Isaiah 5. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine. A homer of seed will yield only a tiny bit of grain. In other words, this is what decreation will feel like. You'll invest and you'll work phenomenally hard. You'll work a whole 10-acre vineyard and you'll get a few bottles of wine. How demoralizing is that? You're going to so invest in your crops, but you're going to get hardly anything back, and your barns will probably be empty at the end. That's demoralizing to live in that kind of state. And I'm sure some of the room can say, yeah, I relate to that. I'm working phenomenally hard at something, and there's no breakthrough. Does, like, God hear my prayers? It's just so hard. I'm working really hard for this promotion, but I'm not getting anywhere. I'm working so hard to get that record contract because I want to break it into the music industry, but nothing's happening. I'm working so hard for this girl to notice me, and she just doesn't seem to notice me. That's what decreation feels like, and it's incredibly painful. It's incredibly painful. Remember, the Jews at this point in the first century when Jesus is telling the story, they've been in decreation for well over 400 years. That's generational now. You know, between the prophets and John the Baptist who came saying, get ready, the Messiah's coming, there's a gap of 400 years without hearing the voice of God. Generationally now, they can't even remember what the voice of God sounds like. They're wondering, has he even given up on us? We've seen no kingdom breakthrough for centuries now. Decreation sucks. But this is what recreation will look like. Next slide. This is what Amos said. Chapter 9, he says, the days are coming. In other words, one day this is going to break in upon you, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman. The harvest will be so plentiful, you'll be desperately trying to get more crops in the ground so you can have the harvest. The reaper will be overtaken by the plowman, the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from the hills. Wow! And I'll bring my people Israel back from exile. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. I'll plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I've given them, says the Lord your God. Can you hear the echoes of Eden right there? It's a place of plenty. I'm going to give them the land. They'll never be uprooted. I'll never kick them out again. This is what recreation will feel like. We'll be drinking wine and chilling out, dipping bread in our olive oil and tasting olives. And we'll be enjoying it all. This is the life we were made for. And for the Jews in the first century, this is like, this is their hope. Life sucks right now. We haven't heard God speak for 400 years. But we know that one day recreation is going to break in upon us, and we're desperate for that moment. So when Jesus tells this story about sowing seed, and you sow some of it, no fruit, lands on the path and it gets eaten by the birds. You sow some of it, ends up in the bushes and the thorns, like choke it, and you throw some of it, ends up on the stony ground. You're working incredibly hard, but there's no return, and it's demoralizing. Then suddenly, you throw some and it lands on great soil. And the yield, the return, it's 30, 60, 100-fold. I mean, that's supernatural activity. You can't explain that humanly. An amazing, amazing return. What is Jesus saying through this parable? How does it explain Mark 1, 2, 3? He's basically saying you've been in decreation, and it sucks, and it's painful. You feel like you've been living life under a curse as the Romans humiliate you and oppress you and put this tax system upon you. But I'm telling you now, recreation is happening. You see how I'm forgiving people and I'm healing the sick and casting out demons and liberating people and drawing broken people into family? I'm the agent of recreation because I am the creator. This is absolutely incredible. So that's the theology done. Now let's try and apply that to our lives. I want to ask a question. How can we be fruitful when we live life in a desert? How can we be fruitful when we live life in a desert? Because I don't know about you, but when I look around, you know, I see moments where the kingdom seems to be breaking in. But I'm thinking, I mean, this isn't like revival. It's not like we're seeing thousands come to faith and stories left, right and center of people getting healed and churches rammed. More often than not, I hear stories of churches closing down and dying. You know, and I'm thinking, whoa, are people seeing kingdom breakthroughs in their workplaces, or is it sometimes just a bit of a struggle? How can we be fruitful in a desert type existence? Or how can we be agents of recreation to the context of decreation? How can we do that? And the very simple answer that Jesus provides is you've got to stay close to me. I'm the creator and I'm the recreator. If you want to be agents of recreation, you've got to stay incredibly close to me. Listen to how he puts it. This is John 15. He says, I'm the vine, you are the branches. If you want to be fruitful, here's how it's going to work. If you remain in me and I in you, you're going to bear much fruit. If you stay close to me, you're going to bear incredible fruit. He says, apart from me, you can do nothing. You know, you can work phenomenally hard, but if it's disconnected from me, the source of life, in terms of kingdom fruit, you can do nothing. And he goes on, you didn't choose me, I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit. Why did God choose you? So that you'd be fruitful, so you'd know fruit in your own life. But more than that, you'd bear fruit so that others can experience the goodness and grace of God. How do we stay close to Jesus? Now, there's a book that I've been reading, because it is a great book, called The Five Love Languages. Just put your hand in the air if you've heard of or read the book, The Five Love Languages. Okay, it's basically this American psychologist, therapist type person who observed that humans tend to communicate their love in five different ways. I'm going to put them on the screen now, so next slide. We communicate our love through quality time, acts of service, gifts, words of affirmation, and physical touch. And this is a great insight. And I think it's generally pretty true. He then uses his insight to sell a book, Five Love Languages for Marrieds, Five Love Languages for Singles, Five Love Languages for Toddlers, Five Love Languages for Teenagers, and Five Love Languages for Your Pets. So he's done pretty well out of this one idea. I think you'll agree, we respect him for that. But his initial insight is actually amazing. He says that basically most of us communicate one or two of these languages fluently. We speak them all a little bit, but one or two we're really fluent in. And if we're going to receive love, we need to receive it by someone speaking these languages. So in the context of marriage, you learn what your partner's languages are, and you learn how to communicate them so that they can experience love. Now, I'm going to do something that's almost certainly heresy, but we're just going to go with it and see where it takes us. I want to try and apply this to our relationship with God. How can we give and receive love when it comes to our relationship with Jesus? Because if that's the relationship that enables us to bear fruit, if intimacy with Jesus is the means by which we're going to be fruitful, not just in our own lives, but for the sake of the world around us, then we've got to learn how to do intimacy well. We've got to find out ways of how can we stay connected to the vine, because that's how we're going to bear fruit. Not just for our own sake, but for the sake of the world. This is perhaps the most fundamental question in discipleship. How do I stay close to Jesus? Got to take it seriously. So I'll do whatever it takes to try and communicate it. And if it means talking about these guys' five languages, I'll give it a shot. So let's just work through quality time with Jesus. Honest, what does quality time with Jesus look like for you? Can I tell you what quality time doesn't look like by just telling you a story? Happened about a year ago with my youngest son, Josh. It was Sunday morning. It was about 6 in the morning. No human being should be up at that time in the morning, but I was up. And the way B and I work it is we take it in turns. So one of us will get up with whichever kid rises first and we'll take them downstairs and hang out. The other one can lie in. And when I say lie in until about 7:30. Not like a student lying until midday. So one of us gets up at 6, the other at 7:30. So I get up at 6, I take Josh downstairs, we go into the living room, I put a few toys out for him to play with, and I turn on the TV, because the night before, I'd recorded Match of the Day, which is a stroke of genius. So I wake up and I turn on Match of the Day, and I get lost in the football. Like, I'm just watching the action, the goals. I'm just totally in the zone. And I've forgotten that there is a kid under the age of one just roaming in this room somewhere. I don't know where he is. But after about half an hour of watching the football, I hear this voice saying, "Daddy, daddy, daddy." And I do what any loving father would do. I ignore the voice. So I keep on watching the football because it's getting to an exciting part. And he's like, "Daddy, daddy, daddy." And I'm like, just ignore it. It will go away. And there's this really intense bit in the game, and I'm thinking, are they going to score, are they not? So I'm desperately trying to focus on that, but his voice gets higher and a bit more urgent, like, "Daddy, daddy, daddy." I'm like, "One minute, Josh, 1 minute." And he's like, "Daddy, daddy, daddy." And I just can't compete anymore, so I press pause, which I should have done all along, and I turn to my son and I say, "What?" in a state of frustration. I'm not proud of this. I just say, like, "What?" And there he is, standing like this. He's got two hands full of poo. So I don't know what had happened. He'd obviously gone to scratch his backside and got more than he bargained. But by this point, he's tried to pull off his nappy. He's got poo all down his leg. It's all in his hands. I'm like, "Stay still. Like, do not move." And again, I do what any loving father would do. I shout for mum. "B, you got to get down here. You got to clean this kid up." No, I'm joking. I didn't do that. So I take Josh. I take him to the bathroom, I give him a bath, I wash all the poo off while retching myself. I then put on a nappy, I go back into the room, I turn off Match of the Day and I start playing on the floor with him. That's quality time. First half, that wasn't quality time. I was in the room with him, but that wasn't quality time. I could have well been in the kitchen and just locked him in the living room and said, "Play." He was there and he was calling to me, but I wasn't with him. It's not quality time. Suddenly I realise, you can't do this. He wants to be with me, so suddenly I get down on the floor and I start playing when he's all cleaned up. And I just realise, you know, maybe in my relationship with God, you know, I have my quiet times and I'm trying to sort of like be with him, but like, I'm distracted. I'm thinking of my to-do list. Maybe I'm reading my Bible, and rather than actually letting it speak to me, I'm thinking that'd be a great insight for next week's sermon. And I'm constantly in my own world, and I find it hard just to press the pause button and be still and say, "God, you know what? I'm going to shut up for a little while. Just going to be still in your presence. Speak. I'm going to read your Bible, and rather than using it for my own agenda, I'm just let it speak to me. Or I'm going to just bring before you the things of my heart." Can I just say, I don't teach this stuff as someone that's mastered it or even getting close to mastering it. This is a daily struggle for me. I'm an activist. I find it really hard to be still. But I know if I want to be fruitful for the sake of the kingdom, and I desperately do, I've got to figure it out. You've got to figure it out. What does quality time look like? Is it the beginning of the day, 15 minutes? You read a bit of the Bible, you have 5 minutes in silence, and then 5 minutes just praying, bringing before God the things on your heart? Is it the end of the day? Is it your lunch break? You get an hour lunch. I think legally that's the deal. We'll take 45 minutes and then walk around the streets of your workplace and pray and listen and have some quality time. Your fruitfulness, and I really mean this, it depends on it. Your fruitfulness depends on it. Quality time, let's just go through the second one, acts of service. And Jesus says, if you love me, you'll obey my commands. You'll do the stuff I told you to do. So what did he tell us to do? He told us to preach the gospel, to cast out demons, to pray for the sick, to experience healing, to care for widows and orphans, to love our neighbours as ourselves. He told us to do all of this stuff. So how is doing that stuff, in other words, serving God, how does that actually strengthen our relationship? And the answer is, it strengthens our relationship because when we do that stuff, we do it with him. When he commissioned his disciples, they go and preach the gospel to all nations. Behold, I'll be with you always. Like when you do the stuff I've told you to do, you're not doing it on your own. You're doing it with me. It's a shared adventure. You know, when you read the gospels, the stories of Jesus and his disciples, they must have been so tight at the end of this 3 years together because they've done so much together. Shared activity leads to intimacy. Let me give you one more story of my kids and then I'm done with kids' stories. Okay, so this is a story from 2 days ago with my eldest son, Benj. So B had been in bed because she was feeling really rough with the cold. So I took the kids out for the day. We went to a park and then just did other things to sort of like burn off energy. And I get home about 4:30. I'm spent. I'm absolutely spent. Parents will know what I'm talking about. And you're like, oh, I've got to find energy just to do the next bit until the sort of bedtime routine. As we're walking home and we get up our stairs, Ben says to me, Daddy, can we just sit down and watch The Gruffalo on TV? I'm thinking, amen to that. Yes, we can. So we get upstairs and I turn on the TV, put on the video, The Gruffalo, and then we start watching The Gruffalo together. And he's kind of lost in it. He absolutely loves The Gruffalo. I'm less so. So I pull out my phone and I'm just checking some emails. Then I think I'll have a look at BBC Sports, see what the rugby score and football score is. So I'm just going through my phone and suddenly he clocks it. He says, Daddy, are you on your phone? Like, yeah, I'm just doing a couple of emails. He's like, but isn't it your day off? And I'm like, oh, busted by a four-year-old. I'm like, Ben, just promise me you won't tell Mum. I'll put my phone away, just don't tell Mum about this. So anyway, I kind of like, inside I'm having this dialogue with Ben, which goes something like this. The thing is, Ben, you want to watch The Gruffalo. Daddy doesn't really want to watch The Gruffalo. Like, Daddy's watched The Gruffalo once a week for the last year. Daddy's read The Gruffalo before bed, probably 2 or 3 times a week for the last year. I know The Gruffalo inside out. Hands up if you know what I'm talking about. Anyone? The Gruffalo said that no Gruffalo should ever set foot in a deep, dark wood. Why not? Why not? Because if you do, the big bad mouse will be after you. I met him once, said The Gruffalo. I met him a long, long time ago. What does he look like? Tell us, Dad. Is he terribly big and terribly bad? I could go through the whole book with him. And I'm thinking, like, Benj, you love it. I'm happy just to be on BBC Sport right now. But this is what he says. He says, Daddy, I want to watch it with you. And that was the thing. It was like, ah. Oh. He didn't want to watch The Gruffalo. He wanted to watch The Gruffalo with me. It makes all the difference. See, when Jesus says, I want you to serve, he's not like, just do this stuff. I've done my bit. Now I've passed the baton on. You do it. No, when you do this stuff, you do it with me. It's shared activity. And shared activity develops intimacy. If you want to stay connected to the vine, which is the means to being fruitful, you have to find ways of serving Jesus. So what's your way of serving Jesus? Where do you do it? Like, if you're not sure where you do it right now, there's loads of opportunities. Find Nemi Luff and say, look, can I come and hang out with XLP that go onto the estate and work with young kids at the point of getting involved in gang culture? Maybe find Andy and Lucy Claspen and say, look, can I join you as you go on the Bemerton estate and work with isolated, vulnerable, elderly women? Because I just want to serve. There's so many opportunities. Talk to us. You need to find a place to serve Jesus because your faith comes alive in the context. Listen to Mark 3, the chapter before. This is when he chooses the 12. He says he appointed the 12 that they might be with him. That's it. Well, why does he appoint people? So that they can be with him. It's about the friendship. And that he might send them to preach and have authority to drive out demons. He appoints them to be with him for shared activity. I'm going to race through the other three gifts. How does gifts develop intimacy with Jesus? Very quickly, Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. Where your treasure is, where you spend your money, that's where you'll find your heart. that's where you'll find your heart. We don't give to local church, to kingdom initiatives, to people that we love. We don't give, hopefully, so that God will love us more, because he couldn't love us anymore. He just loves us so much. We don't give so that he could love us more. We give so that we could love him more. And again, there's a world of difference. When we give to things that belong to the kingdom, our heart follows. When we give to local church, that's why I believe it's absolutely fundamental for Christians to be financially back in the local church. So if you're from another church, back your local church, because in giving your money, you're giving your heart. And when you give your heart to the local church, you see kingdom stuff begin to take place. You know, if it's not the local church, find causes that you believe in. A tear fund, a compassion, something that's close to your heart, a nation that's close to your heart. Maybe people that you know are going through hard times. When you give your money, you give your heart. So when we give to God, it develops intimacy. Fourth thing, words. Words of affirmation. How does speaking words to God develop intimacy? Like telling God, I love you, which is essentially what worship is. When we gather together and sing these songs, we're essentially saying, God, thank you that you love me so much. I love you back. You know, we have different ways of saying it, different songs, but essentially that's the logic of worship. Why does telling God I love you strengthen the relationship and build intimacy? Because some could say, well, is God insecure? Like, does God need to be reminded regularly? Like, is he saying, oh, Pete hasn't worshipped me for 3 weeks. I'm just not sure what he thinks of me. Like, you know, I didn't answer his last prayer. I had good reasons not to answer it, but it's like, I'm just really worried. He hasn't told me that he loves me. Do you think it's all right, Holy Spirit? Do you think it's all right? Do you think it's okay with me? There isn't that level of dialogue within the Trinity, because there's no insecurity in the Trinity. It's perfect security. We don't tell God, I love you, because he needs it. He wants it. He loves it. It brings him joy. He deserves it. He's worthy of it. It brings him glory, but we tell him we love him because it does something to us. When I come here on a Sunday and say, God, I remember again what you've done for me at the cross, and you poured yourself out that I might know fullness of life. God, you're a mate, man. I just want to say I love you. As I begin to engage in that conversation, my love for God is strengthened and intimacy begins to form as I encounter Jesus. I don't do it for his sake because he's insecure. You know, he deserves it. He longs for it, but he's not insecure. Sometimes I do it for my sake because I need reminding of what God is like and that I love him. Final one, physical touch. Now, how do you stretch the illustration to include physical touch? I've been thinking about it all week and I've been pretty creative. I think you'll like what I've done with this. So, when it comes to displaying love in terms of physical touch towards God, what does that look like? Well, it looks like worship. When the Apostle Paul defines worship, he says, in view of mercy, in other words, what God has done for us at the cross, giving his son Jesus, in view of what he's done, I urge you, brothers and sisters, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. That's your spiritual act of worship. I urge you to offer your, not your hearts, not your souls, your bodies. In other words, worship is bodily. When we come and we offer worship, often it is bodily. What does that look like? Well, maybe sometimes it looks like bowing down and kneeling before God. We don't do that much in our tradition, but we should do maybe more. Because it's a physical way of saying, God, you know what? You're God, and I'm not. And your agenda matters more than my agenda. So I'm going to physically do something now. I'm going to kneel down as a way of acknowledging that. And sometimes when you do an outward thing, an inward thing then takes place. Why do we raise our hands in worship? Because I know some people think that's just weird and it's crazy and it's just hyped up. Why do we raise hands in worship? It's a way of saying, God, I lift you up. You're worthy and I acknowledge you and I want to lift your name on high rather than my own name. So sometimes, you know, we do that. If you go to a football match and someone scores a goal, what do? They lift their hands in the air and they probably hug each other, some cry. But they're celebrating. Not because they've been taught when someone scores a goal. What you do is like, as soon as you possibly can, you jump to your feet if you've been sitting down, you put your hands in the air, you smile at everyone, like, and then you hug people. That no one's taught them that. It's instinctive. They're celebrating something that's happened on the pitch. And when we encounter God, it's like we celebrate who he is. We put our hands in the air or we do something bodily. Do we do it because God's insecure? It's like, they haven't put their hands in the air. Are they not really that keen? God's not insecure. We do it because it reminds us, God, like, you're worthy. There's times when I come to worship here at KXC and I'm feeling nothing. And I don't feel like I've got lots of things on the top of my mind that I just need to thank God for and celebrate. And there's times when I'm thinking, I'm just struggling to engage. And do you know what? I put my hands up in those moments. Why? As a way of saying, God, I might not feel something right now, but I choose to worship you. And I choose to say, you're worthy. However I'm feeling, you're worthy. And I choose to say, you know, you did this for me. It's a fact that you died on a cross. And I don't feel much right now, but I'm saying, I'm grateful. And I just put my hand up as a bodily way of engaging. You know when I do that? Often my heart follows. Where you give your money, your heart follows. Where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. I think it's true. Where your body is, your heart will follow. And sometimes we engage bodily because our hearts follow. So Jesus tells this story, and I'm learning with this thing, of this seed suddenly going out, and there's an incredible harvest. Incredible. And he's essentially saying to his disciples, I'm inviting you into my ministry to be agents of recreation. How are you going to do it? How are you going to do it? You be with me. You stay connected to me. I'm the vine, you're the branches. If you stay close to me, you're going to bear phenomenal fruit. We want to see fruit, don't we, in KXC, in King's Cross, in our workplaces. People coming to faith. People coming out of gangs and into community. People coming out of the sex work and whatever else. Vulnerable mums finding community. We want to see elderly, isolated people drafting community. There's so much we long to see. Your workplaces, think about it. There's probably so much you long to see in your homes, on your streets, in your family. There's so much. How? Stay connected to Jesus. So let's stand.